Greetings, my friends. Thanks for tuning in to the Women and Wellness podcast series. I'm your host, Cara Foreman, and in this first episode, I'm going to be speaking with a fabulous woman named Terry Folks. Terry is a Canadian certified counselor, a spiritually integrated psychotherapist, and a registered clinical counselor, and she has a thriving practice in the Comox Valley on beautiful Vancouver Island in Canada. And Terry specializes primarily in women's issues. Now, in this episode, Terry is going to be talking to us about a discovery tool that she uses in her practice called the Wellness Wheel. And she's going to walk us through all four quadrants in the wheel: the physical, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual. And this tool is really valuable for determining where you might be a little out of balance in your life and how you might claim that balance back for yourself. Now, if you want to learn more about Terry, a little more about her bio, you can find that and the show notes, along with a blank wellness wheel template in case you want to download it and follow along. You'll find that all on the show notes page for this episode, and that will be at caraforeman.com/wellness wheel. You can also leave a comment at the bottom of that page. We'd love to hear back from you what your experience was listening to it, what insights you might have gotten, and how you might use the wheel yourself in your life. So please feel free to do that. We'd love to hear from you. And I hope you enjoy this episode. And now, here's Terry. So, Terry, very nice to be chatting with you. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. So,
well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's I think it's going to be fun. And I'll have told our audience a little about you in the intro, so I'm just going to jump right in. And what I'd love to talk about first is just to get an idea of who you are and your background and what got you to where you are today.
So, yeah, I'm thinking back to when I was 12 or 13, and I was unusual in my peer group because I was reading Gloria Steinem and I was reading Ms. Magazine. And I was quite aware of the women in my family and in the circle, social circle that my family was involved in. And I didn't understand how women weren't aware of their power because I hadn't lost mine yet. And so that interest actually had me volunteering for a shelter in Northern Alberta called the Yellowhead Shelter for Women. And I was 13 or 14 when I began volunteering and trying to raise money for a shelter for women who were on the run. And that's pretty young. I realize in retrospect that my passion for women and their power and realizing it started pretty young. And I don't think I could articulate that then, but I know now in retrospect that that's where it began. And then, you know, I became a teacher. I got my first degree and I watched the girls in late junior high and early high school start relinquishing their power and giving it away. And I really did a lot of soul searching and thinking about this and wondered what's next for me. And then I was still working on volunteer committees for women and women who were abused and women who experienced sexual trauma. And all of this fed my passion. And then I was given an opportunity to consider another degree. And I had considered an MDiv, a Master's in Divinity, and to become ordained. And my therapist at the time said, you know, Terry, you have this passion for women, and you might actually be able to help them realize their power, more women realize their power in a clinical setting or a counseling setting, more than in a church setting. And then my spiritual trajectory took off into a different place, and I left the Christian tradition, and or I incorporated it, I should say, probably more accurately. I incorporated into a more holistic spiritual view, and made a decision to go for a Master's of Arts in counseling. And during that training, which was pretty rigorous, I discovered that my passion for helping women save their own lives could be realized in this degree, and that I could open my practice and specialize in women and women's issues. So, yeah,
cool.
That's where I am today.
Cool. Well, you know, interesting that at 13, 14, I mean, usually we're pretty self-centered at that age. Although, I mean, I say that realizing that at 13, 14, I was also very, you know, like interested in Eastern mysticism and stuff, but it was very self-oriented, right? And when you look at a lot of kids who are 13, 14, they seem pretty self-centered. So for you to be already in that mode of serving others and supporting others, I think is pretty remarkable. And cool that you found a way to express that, that then, you know, sort of moved you forward toward clarifying that it was really around women and their power.
And I'm not sure that it was definitely self. It was egocentric in that I thought that I could rescue women, which isn't very healthy. So by the time I got my MA late, 45, I was aware that I couldn't do this work if I thought I was going to rescue anybody.
Right.
So the whole point of teaching people how to rescue themselves and that they have everything that they already need within, and that I'm just drawing that out or helping them to remember or recognize that power.
Yeah.
That was definitely not there at 13 or 14. Yes, I was definitely self-serving, thinking I was the big superhero and I was going to rescue anyone who wanted to be rescued.
I think that's the gift of the teens, though, right? Is that believing that you can change the world. I mean, at some point, we have to believe we can change the world in order to drive ourselves forward.
Right? One woman at a time, Tara. One woman
with,
at a time.
With self first.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's cool. So I know that you use a variety of tools in your practice. And actually, let's start with this. Tell me about who your clientele are. Like, you know, you focus on a specific cohort of people in your practice. So who are your primary clients?
So my practice, for whatever reason, and I'm sure that if I actually analyze that, I could come up with the reasons. But my practice attracts professional women, who I have doctors and lawyers and nurses and teachers and principals and bankers and women in a variety of professions. But I also have retired professional women, women who are experiencing their awakening post-retirement. And then I have professional moms who are working at home but not getting paid.
Right.
So, yeah, that's my primary.
I love that. Professional moms. That's wonderful, right? Moms are so undervalued in more ways than just financial. So you don't work with men?
Oh, I have a few men,
yeah,
but not very many. I would say probably 95% of my client base are women.
Right. All right. Cool. Okay. So as I started to say, I know you use a variety of tools, and I'm looking forward to talking about a number of them over the course of this series. But today we're going to focus on a tool that's called the Wellness Wheel. So can you give us sort of a high level description of what the wellness wheel is?
And yeah. So the wellness wheel originally was some of the work that was being done on the wellness wheel is done by Linda Myers out of the University of Calgary. And she had her wellness wheel divided into 8 segments, and I divide mine into 4, which are the traditional, if you think about, you kind of imagine that you and I are in a village squatting in the dirt, and I'm your medicine woman, or I'm your shaman. I'm not going to have any paper or pencil or anything, but I will assess your balance in 4 realms. So that's one way to assess a balance. And any healer, if they're holistic in their approach, will be looking at your physical self, your mental or intellectual self, your spiritual self, and your emotional self. And the wellness wheel, really, we don't compartmentalize our lives that way. It's split just for convenience sake. So many activities overlap. And the best example is yoga. When I'm doing my yoga practice, I'm actually addressing all 4 dimensions of the wheel.
Right.
But for the sake of convenience, we look at the 4 realms separately and then begin to integrate them later on in a conversation that I might have with a client. So really, I'm assessing. I use it as an assessment tool for balance in the first session. It's wonderful because it the story unfolds as we're talking about each dimension. And then I get to hear where they're at and where the imbalance is. And I get to teach compassion. Because when we talk about each segment of the wheel, everybody's wheel is a little wobbly at different times in their life. For example, if you're focused on postpartum, looking after your new baby, certain parts of your wheel are going to be put to one side and you're going to feel a little imbalanced, but it's an artifact of where you're at developmentally, like in your life. Having a new baby changes your wheel.
Right.
And sometimes we're more focused on the intellectual or mental aspect of our wheel. If we're studying, getting a degree or a certificate or a diploma of some kind, or we're just studying, sometimes we're in our head a lot. So everybody's wheel is off balance from time to time. But my concern is the women who are taking care of everybody else's wheels.
Right.
Helping them schedule self-care, their dental appointments, their all the things that they need to do to keep themselves whole at her own expense.
Right.
So my concern is for a woman who's giving so much to so many in so little time that there's no time left for her.
Right.
So, and over time, that affects the physical body, and it also affects her sense of what I call I am-ness. Her understanding of who she is,
right,
as a person. So that's the wheel kind of broadly.
Yeah.
Like a broad look at how I use the wheel. And then I'll use it. I'll come back to it in later sessions. And we'll kind of go back in and see how the balance has shifted a little bit.
Right. So it's almost a, like it sounds like it's a good, a measurement tool, or like an ongoing assessment tool, because mm-hmm. as you say, it shifts and changes. And but it seems like it would be a valuable check-in tool for where they're at, right?
So the yeah, and another reason why I love this tool is because as I say, their story emerges in first session as we're going through each of those 4 dimensions. And I love that because then I get to know them pretty quickly and pretty efficiently.
Right.
And I want to know their world. I'm unabashedly curious about the universe of each person I'm serving. And this gives me the first layer. And it's pretty exciting. Honorable work. Love that. I have a quote from Rumer Godin. It comes from a house with four rooms. And this might kind of give a better sort of big, broad picture of why I use the wellness wheel. So Rumer Godin says there's a Aboriginal proverb or axiom that says that everyone is a house with four rooms, a physical, a mental, an emotional, and a spiritual. And most of us tend to live in one room most of the time. But unless we go into every room every day, even if only to keep it aired, we're not a complete person. Well, I think not a complete person is overstating it slightly, but you kind of get the idea,
we're
right?
We're not, Karen? A balanced person.
That's it.
Yeah.
And that brings me to self-compassion. And self-compassion is the backbone of my therapy practice, because living in a patriarchal culture, women are far too hard on themselves, and they judge themselves harshly and evaluate themselves in a way that's unfair. And it's based on a structure that's created by the culture that they live in, that isn't really authentic and it isn't true to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to share this one piece with you about my practice. So when a person honors me by being vulnerable, it's imperative that I teach them self-compassion. And that starts in the first 5 minutes, and it starts with this wheel. And when you show me how you're paying attention to your physical self, you need to be compassionate with yourself if you notice that you're not perfect. Right?
Right.
And so who is perfect? And so I set that tone right at the very beginning. And when you tell me that you don't normally think about your spiritual life, you need to feel unconditionally accepted by me. You need to be able to be given permission to extend that courtesy toward yourself. If I'm extending it towards you. And that brings me to a different modality, which we're going to talk about later in this series, which is my counseling approach. And when you confess that you've never considered the difference between the emotional or intellectual parts of yourself, I need to reassure you that you're now embarking on this amazing journey of self-discovery. So I take great pride, Kara, in showing people how to stop allowing that critical voice to shame or blame or demoralize them when they're really wanting to improve their awareness in each of those four dimensions. So the key to using the wheel effectively is to invite each person to be as curious about their own lives as I am.
Right.
So that, the goal is self-compassion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I can totally see, I think that probably it's not gender specific to have that sense of wanting to be better, but I think that women in particular are trained from a very, very early age that if they're not perfect, that they better get on it, right? That they should be working towards it. And I know Brené Brown talks about this in some of her work about how differently men and women organize themselves around shame and that. She's got some very interesting stuff about women being, they have to be, I can't remember what all four of them were, but one of them was that they need to be spending all their resources on making sure that they're beautiful and physically fit and perfect and in all
and
ways.
And that includes the energy.
Yes.
Their own energy, how they're spending it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that if they're focusing too much on other people or focusing too much on themselves, that somehow that's selfish and that really they're held in higher esteem if they're focusing more of their attention on other people and caring more for other people.
Yeah. It's I'm a real, all about changing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you on that, sister. I don't think it serves any of us, least of all ourselves, but I don't think it serves the world either. So
I think one of the cautions with the wellness wheel and using it and calling it an assessment tool is women almost automatically, my clients begin to wanting start setting goals.
Right.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
But that's not the primary purpose of the initial look at the wellness wheel. It's awareness.
Yes.
So that's tricky. How to have compassion for yourself when you know already that you're maybe not paying attention to all aspects of your physical self that you could or should or would be doing if life were different or ideal or brilliant. So it's cautioning people that really what we're doing is just collecting information.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Well, even the word assessment immediately sets up that sense of measurement and how am I measuring up? And so, of course, if I'm not measuring up to whatever my perfected ideal is, then therefore I better get to work on it. And so I'll jump to goals. Okay, yeah. How do I fix this?
I appreciate you saying that. And I think I would maybe give some thought to changing this to a discovery tool.
Yeah, that's even better, I think. It sort of takes the charge off it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting how powerful language is.
Yeah. I like our discovery tool.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kara.
Yeah, you're welcome. This is the beauty of conversation. So one of the things that you mention when talking about the wellness wheel is around, you mentioned awareness, and in something that I read, you mentioned using it as kind of the next level of mindfulness. So, and I immediately went to like mindfulness meditation practice and mm-hmm. practices. Is that what you're referring to, or is it just mindfulness as another word for becoming more aware of where you're at? Or being more aware all the time of where you're at, heightening your awareness.
Yeah, I think that what you just said, because the wheel actually, some people don't even think of their lives as having four domains. It's not something that occurs to them.
Right.
They're spending so much time in their head, they don't even, it doesn't even cross their mind that, oh, well, maybe because I'm spending so much time in my head, I might not be paying much attention to my body or my emotion, my heart connections, or my spirit. And this is just a awakening. It's that level of awareness, bringing that to the forefront. And it's a gift for the rest of their lives to be able to check in on their wheel. I have women who have the wheel on their fridge.
Right.
And it's a reminder. Right. I'm more than my head, or I'm more than my body, or I'm more than my connections to other people. I'm more than that.
Yeah.
I'm whole and I'm integrated and I have at least four dimensions among many, many, many others. So yeah, it's a general awareness, I would say.
Yeah. Well, it seems like a pretty useful map. And I like the idea of having it up on your fridge and sort of as a reminder, you know, keeping it with you. And so tell me a little bit more about the connection between the wobbly wheels and that sense of self or I am-ness. How does that seems obvious to me, but can you think of an example of a wobbly wheel and how it shows up, how it affects your sense of self?
Yeah. So some people look at a wobbly wheel in this way. They think about being overly responsive to other people's needs. It used to be called codependence. Sometimes it still is. So this is a good example of how to bring awareness of self-care to the forefront. If you are focused on serving others. And if you believe that your responsibility or your ability to respond is to others, then your ability to respond to yourself or your own needs is compromised. So your responsibility is compromised towards yourself. So that's a really good example of a wobbly wheel where you might be asked after an extended period of giving to, say, one other person, well, what's your favorite color? What movie would you like to see? Or where would you like to go for dinner? And if you're aware of, oh my God, I don't even know what I like. I don't know what my preferences are. I have a hard time stating where I want to go, what movie I want. Oh, you choose. Oh, you decide, and I'll just go along. That to me is a red flag. That's a wobbly wheel. That's someone who's over responsive to another person at their own expense.
Yeah.
So that's a really kind of, that's a very specific example, but it's also very indicative of the kind of work that I do and what I see happening with a lot of the women that I serve.
Yeah. Well, I can totally relate, having come across that in my world. Not so much myself, but I've definitely seen that in a lot of women. And that makes me curious. It strikes me that moms might have a specific challenge in this area, because if they're caring for children, it's part of their physiological makeup. It's you know, straight from the lizard brain that these beings are their sacred trust, and that they must ensure that they're safe and cared for and thriving. And so I would imagine for moms, that's a pretty big challenge, because there's a correctness to that care of those beings, and yet being able to find that balance.
And this is what makes women amazing.
Yeah.
This is what makes women amazing, is because they can do that. They can set aside some of their needs because they have to focus on this powerless, innocent, needy little person. And yet their spirit knows deep down that at some point they're going to need to practice some adult self-care in order to continue doing this amazing job, the most important job on the planet, which is parenting.
Yeah.
And they understand this and have to juggle this. And if they have some support, either with other women, the sisterhood, or if they decide to come and see a therapist, or if they are willing to talk about this openly in community and support one another, I think that's huge. It makes a big difference.
Yeah. And so much what we need. I think one of the broken pieces of our culture is how much we've lost that sense of community and takes a village to raise a child kind of concept, that we tend to be more isolated and familial, or in the case of single parents, you know, I think that they probably are more likely to reach out for social supports because they have to. But a lot of women in relationship, that where their partner is not necessarily all that conscious, then they really are on their own. And and I can imagine, especially things like sleep, you know, not getting enough sleep, especially in the first year or so.
Well, you know, and that's a good segue into looking at the first dimension of the wheel.
Yeah.
Is the physical self.
Yeah.
So when we look at the wheel, the spiritual, the emotional, the intellectual, and the physical, I always start with the physical because it's the underlying foundational root chakra place to begin.
Right.
It actually affects everything. And so when I think about the physical part of the wheel. So what I'm going to invite the listeners to do is to just imagine the wheel or download the wheel from Kara's website or from my website. Just have a look at it and consider each dimension as we're talking about it. And so when you look at the physical aspect of your wheel and you're trying to determine, well, how much awareness am I paying to my physical self these days? And it's just a general awareness of where are you at with that relative to the other three. So let's just focus on the physical. And so when I think about the physical realm, I start with what I call embodied cognition. And embodied cognition is just that. It's thinking of our bodies from the neck down as our big brain. And our big brain knows everything. And it sends us messages, usually via symptoms. And those messages, it's the big brain trying to talk to us and say, pay attention. Something's going on here. And it's, I call it embodied cognition because it's our body's brain. Mm-hmm. It's the big brain. Mm-hmm. And the stories of women are the stories of embodied cognition because we carry all of our stories in our bodies, right? Yeah. We can point to different parts of our bodies where our lives have turned and taken, gone through phases and gone around that corner or this corner, depending on our age. So I always ask people, well, as an example, do you remember a time when your body spoke to you? And an example is you see your ex at Costco. Where do you feel that? Well, some people feel it in their solar plexus. And some people feel it as their heart beating faster. Or some people feel it as kind of a foggy, all of a sudden they can't hear as well. And there's a foggy sense in their ears and in the way they're thinking or not thinking.
Right.
So I start with, are you getting outside? That's the first thing. Get outside, get some fresh air, use your five senses. What are you doing with that amazing body of yours? Are you hearing the birds? Are you feeling the wind on your face? Are you smelling the scents of nature out there? How are you aware of your body? Most basic.
Yeah.
So that's a really good place to start. Sometimes I'll ask them to try to remember a time in childhood when they were out playing with their friends and they lost all track of time. And their mom or dad calls them in for dinner and they don't even, they have no sense of how long they've been outside. Their skin is fresh and they've been playing and completely in their bodies in a way that I would like them to try to think about returning to.
Yeah. Well, I think that's incredibly important. I know I experience a lot of people as living kind of outside their body system, like they're in their head or whatever. And I notice this in interesting ways, like, and I call it aura manners, because it's like they don't have a sense of your space, you know, or their space. Like people who are talking to you and they just move right close into your space. And I feel very uncomfortable when somebody gets beyond a certain point in my space. And I'll step back and they'll step forward, you know. And I realize that they're totally unconscious to my responses to their physicality. And, you know, and so that's just one example of what I've seen. Because I, you know, I work in the energy field. I'm kind of... Mm-hmm. I notice things on an energetic level a lot of the time. And that's definitely one of the things that I sense is that people spend a lot of their time in their head and very little time in their body. Mm-hmm. And one thing I know from my own experience is that if I'm feeling rattled or stressed or there's something going on in my life, if I don't get out and physically use my body and make my muscles tired, I'll have trouble sleeping because my mind will just keep on running. And so even to just get outside and move around, even if it's not strenuous activity, but just being outside and moving around, it shifts my whole perspective. So
yeah, you bring up that piece around moving the body. So that would be the next piece that I go to, is how are you moving your body? And when I do this, these questions, it's just meant to encourage thought and awareness.
Yeah.
So I might say, and I'm not talking about exercise, I'm talking about how do they move their body in a way that makes them happy?
Yeah.
And that's, for some people, that's a new notion because they've got the shoulds in their brain, and there's no shoulding in my practice at all. but what they go to that automatically, and I'm not talking about exercise. I'm talking about what, if you move your body in a way that makes you happy, then you're stimulating endorphins, serotonin, dopamine, all the positive neurotransmitters, and you know what makes you happy. Some people love the way water feels on their skin, so they swim for the pure pleasure of it. Or some of us need to move in the forest. We need to feel that spongy earth under our feet. It helps us feel connected to Mother Earth. And some of us stop and name the trees and talk to them and greet them every day. This sense of being in your body and moving your body in a way that makes you happy is based on research that says you will not continue with a supposed workout plan or exercise regimen if you don't like what you're doing.
Yeah.
So you might as well do something that makes you happy.
Yeah.
I like to dance.
Yeah.
So I dance almost every day. Well, I guess you could call that exercise. I call it self-care. It feels good. I want to do it. Yeah. It makes me happy. So
the side benefit is that,
well, then you're getting well, you're getting physically well, but it's more than that. This is a good example of where it all, for all four dimensions, it, but because we're talking about the physical, I'm starting there, right? So Kara, I think at this point, it's probably a good time to remind our listeners to either create a circle in their mind's eye and divide it into four quadrants, or to get a piece of paper out and make a circle on the piece of paper and divide it into four quadrants. One quadrant will be physical, one will be mental or intellectual, one will be spiritual, and one will be emotional. And then if our listeners want to work one by one through those four quadrants, I think that would be helpful. So I'd like to start with the physical today, if that's okay with you.
That sounds like a great idea.
And just before we get going, I thought it's also a nice time to remind our listeners of what the kind of work I do in psychotherapy at Spirit First Counseling is straight out of the original definition of psychotherapy, which means soul or breath of life, which that's psyche, and therapeia, which means servant attendant. And together, this designates me as a psychotherapist as a servant or attendant of the soul.
Wow, that's so interesting. I never knew that.
Yeah, so that actually underlies all of the work. And I feel that our time together and our conversations are sacred because they're healing conversations.
Right.
So starting with the medicine wheel or the wellness wheel helps us kind of get an overall picture of a person's life in balance. So if our listeners have a circle in their mind and we're looking at one quadrant, the physical, for example, I think it's probably a good idea to remind our listeners to be compassionate with themselves as they determine some kind of measure of where they're at in their awareness of their physical self. So often what happens when I use the wellness wheel with clients is they begin to be quite hard on themselves and start judging themselves as lacking in some way. And so really what we're talking about here is awareness. So how much awareness or attention are you paying to your physical self? And give yourself some kind of measure on a scale 0 to 10. These days, I'm probably giving my physical self awareness maybe a 7 out of 10. And not judging that, but just saying this is what it is. This is what it is. Right. And then we talk about all the aspects of the physical. So when I start with clients on the physical aspect, I begin with a conversation about embodied cognition. And embodied cognition is just this notion that our bodies are our big brain. And our big brain, neck down brain, the real brain, in my opinion, will give us messages in the form of symptoms. And every woman's story is a story of embodied cognition, because women carry all of the stories in their bodies. And on a daily basis, if you're checking in with your big brain, the body, it will tell you. It is absolutely trustworthy. You can rely on it. If you develop an awareness of your body's language or conversations with you, and you train yourself to listen, and you follow its guidance and advice, you're going to win. You're going to feel, we can all think of examples in our life where our body spoke to us, where we've been maybe overworking and, or we're overstressed, and then a condition, maybe a historical physical condition rises up, and we're aware that our bodies are reminding us that we may be overtaxing ourselves, overworking, or stressed out.
Right. Yeah, I can totally relate to that.
So the first thing I ask when I'm working with women and men is how much fresh air are you getting on a daily basis? And that's pretty basic. But if we could ask our listeners and yourself and me, I love doing this. Think about a time in childhood when you were playing outside and you lost track of time and you're lost in the fresh air and whatever activity you were doing, whether you were sitting on a tree trunk pretending it was a horse riding off it somewhere, or you were playing with your friends running through the woods pretending to be nymphs and fairies, or whether it was kick the can outside. Just go there for a moment. And remember how you felt all of a piece, all of one. You were in your body. There was no, when mom called you for dinner, it was, you had completely lost track of time. And you come in and you smell like summer and the grass and mowed grass and you've got bug bites and you're dirty and it doesn't matter. And if we can remember that time and call it forth and get outside and get our bodies happy again, that's what I recommend in my practice. That's the first prescription.
Yeah.
Get outside, get moving. Move your body in a way that pleases you. Get those endorphins, the serotonin, the dopamine, all those positive mood, uplifting neurotransmitters. Get them to the surface. I can tell you that being outside, one tree gives off enough oxygen to feed a family of four. So really, if you're outside enjoying the air, enjoying oxygen, being outside, filling yourself up, this is another statistic is if you're outside 45 minutes, some moderate activity, that's the equivalent of a mild antidepressant. So you can actually,
without the side effects.
What were you going to say?
When you were talking about, you know, being a kid, for us, it was when the streetlights came on. That's when we had to come in, right? And I remember kind of times when I would dread seeing the streetlights come on because I didn't want to go in yet. And the streetlights come on just as dusk is happening. So it's not dark yet, right?
Yeah, we still have a few more minutes.
So you'd stretch, you know, as long as you could. And the other thing about being outside, when I had my dog, and of course, you know, she had to have a walk twice a day, right? So I was out in the woods, and I tended to take her to the woods because we're so fortunate where we live that there are so many different options of woods to go walk in. And man, that's when I got all my great ideas. I ended up starting having to carry either a notepad or a recorder, because all my great ideas would come when I was out walking the dog.
Yeah.
You know, just an amazing, nourishing, refueling, you know, and I'd come back to my computer and be completely fresh, mm-hmm. you know. And then, of course, when my dog passed, I stopped walking every day. And it was like, oh, you know.
Yeah, so. And that brings me back to, well, we happen to live in a part of the world here on Vancouver Island where we can be outside every day,
yeah.
regardless, if we have the right clothing. And we don't need a dog.
No.
But yeah, the dog inspires us. But really, if part of the work of my practice is to remind you that you can take yourself, you actually have a responsibility to take yourself for a walk every day.
Well, and that's
to be your own dog.
The key that I was doing that for my dog, but wasn't doing it for myself, right? So
it comes back to that old, you'll hear me say it, I'm a broken record when it comes to saying, schedule the appointment with yourself.
Right.
Right. Put it on your calendar. What you would do for your child, your dog, your elderly mother who might need your care, you make appointments for them and you keep them. You wouldn't even imagine not making that commitment or that obligation. And that brings me to, being outside in the fresh air, moving your body in a happy way. And I use that language quite precisely and on purpose, because I'm not talking about exercise here or working out. Or an exercise regime. I'm talking about moving your body in a way that makes you feel good. And that guarantees, the research is in on that, that guarantees your commitment, because you'll be having fun, loving the time. And when you're not doing it, you'll miss it.
Yeah.
And so you kind of make it a priority in your life. So some people love to dance. So they're doing Zumba. Or some people love to run and it really helps with their anxiety. It releases something when they're running through the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get unplugged for that happy movement is really important. There are people who do 10 sun salutations every morning. It's their practice. If they don't do it, they miss it.
Yeah.
If you can get outside to do it, or at least walk to the activity and then do the activity and be outside again after. Some people love to swim. They love the way the water feels on their bodies,
mm-hmm.
right? So whatever makes your body feel happy. And that I think is really key. Sleep hygiene is pretty basic stuff. So I ask about sleep hygiene. Rate yourself. When you're looking at that part of the wheel, think about how is the quality of my sleep? What's happened over the years? And I teach sleep hygiene. I talk about turning off the technology 2 hours prior. I talk about what light you're using in your room. I talk about mindfulness and slowing down and getting to that really quiet, still place where it's natural to fall into deep slumber. There's natural things you can take too. There's melatonin. People have found different forms of natural products that help them. Some people have special sleepy time teas that they use. Some people switch to candlelight around 9 o'clock at night. There's lots of ways of improving your sleep hygiene and improving your sleep. Sleep is basic. I mean, I do serve some men, but most of the women, people I serve are women, and women tend to have sleep challenges. So we spend a fair amount of time on sleep.
There was I recently listened to a great podcast. I think the guy's name was Matt Walker. It was Kevin Rose's podcast, and really fascinating stuff on sleep. And I had heard another guy with, I think it might have been Joe Rogan, was interviewing another guy, another sleep expert. But man, when they talk about the cost of missing even an hour of sleep, on longevity, on mental health, on all these different physiological and psychological aspects, how important sleep is and how we get not enough of it. And so I would recommend both of those podcasts to listeners. They were really informative, and I've shifted a bunch of things as a result. And some of those things were things like turning the lights down, you know, a couple of hours before, because your mind starts to realize it's time for bed. And they talked about coffee, and I stopped drinking regular coffee a while ago because I really found it was interrupting my sleep a lot. But this guy was saying that, you know, you have a cup of coffee in the morning, it takes like 16 hours for that coffee to leave your system. It's got a half-life of 6 hours, but a half-life doesn't mean that 12 hours it's all gone. So if you're going to have a cup of regular coffee, you want to do it like first thing in the morning and then stop, because otherwise it's going to impact your sleep, right? A whole bunch of really interesting pieces on sleep.
I think we're just now starting to realize
how
important sleep is. That actually connects to when our listeners are looking at their wellness wheel. We're looking at each segment separately, but they all work together. I mean, we're, you know, we split them for the sake of convenience.
Right.
But sleep underpins everything. And it really speaks to my hope that we all develop more respect for our rhythm, for our body's rhythms, and what our big brain needs to be fed. First and foremost, it's time to rejuvenate and heal and revive through sleep. That's our big brain. Our body needs that time.
Mm-hmm.
So then that brings me to happy food. And I use the term happy food in the way that I say move your body in a happy way. So if you know the source of your food, if you know those cows were treated well and they're free and they can eat grass, and if you know how those chickens were treated, if you're eating meat even at all, if you know the source of your food, I'm not talking necessarily about the 100-mile diet, but I am talking about developing responsibility for knowing where your food source, where the food is coming from, where are the sources of your food,
mm-hmm.
and developing a sense of your big brain, your body's responses to certain kinds of food, because there's no one size fits all. Everybody's big brain responds differently to different food. And you can experiment and find out what's right for you. But at the end of the day, what you're putting in your body, I hope that you're choosing happy food, that you know who created it, what the source is, if it was created with love, giving thanks for food. And I'm not talking about a religious ritual here. I'm just talking about acknowledging where the food came from.
Mm-hmm.
So it can become a spiritual practice, and it affects how your body receives it, digests it, and eliminates it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a whole process there. I talk about hydration with my clients. There are some myths out there about water consumption. Your body, your big brain will tell you if you're thirsty, you listen, you drink. It's not necessarily a rule that how much water you're supposed to drink, and that rule applies to everybody. And people forget that there's water in most foods. So I acknowledge the importance of water, but I also ask listeners to be cautious about following these so-called rules about hydration. I ask people about their posture. I ask about their hip alignment, especially for women. Are you in need of orthotics? Is it time to go get yourself checked out? Are you still comfortable in bare feet, or have you moved away from that? Have you worn shoes for so long that now wearing bare, you know, having bare feet isn't actually a healthy choice for you?
Right.
Do you need to go talk to someone and get yourself fitted? Because people will put up with pain in strange places for for a long time before they start looking into it.
Well, we become accustomed. Like we acclimatize to our discomfort. So it does require that you really, that you're aware, that you continue to deepen your awareness of what's going on with your body. Well, and that goes with food and
makes everything. Me think of work. It makes me think of people who are overworked. They just get used to it. Like you said, they acclimatize to that. They acclimatize to feeling exhausted. And when they feel good, they're not really sure what to do with that.
Yeah.
And that brings me back to respecting your biorhythm, your own rhythms, and acknowledging, spending some time acknowledging what your preferences are and being okay with stating those preferences. You're actually responsible for them. So that brings me to the last couple of pieces under physical would be if my clients are comfortable talking about their sexual health, I'll go there with them. So that's, again, a respect for your own rhythm, a respect for your own preferences, learning how to please yourself, how to feel safe and intimate in intimacy. And as far as the client wants to talk about it, it's all part of the physical realm. So we also start talking a little bit about addictions, because it falls under the physical, it falls under the spiritual, emotional, and intellectual as well, but tends to manifest itself in the physical realm. So I do a lot of work in addictions, and I'm a quick coach for the BC Lung Association. I acknowledge that sobriety, or the cutting off of the substance of choice, is only the beginning.
Right.
That there are years of recovery following sobriety. I tend to use motivational interviewing when I'm working with people who are confronting their addiction. And that's a modality in psychotherapy that just looks at where a person is in the process of change. It's a trans-theoretical model. So it's like, are they pre-contemplative? Are they contemplative? Is there a readiness for change? Where are they at?
Uh-huh.
And trying to scan that and figure out, and then harm reduction. So I was trained at the Comox Valley Mental Health and Addiction Services is where I did my practicum. And it's a harm reduction site, which means that if the person's going to use, then we show them, teach them how to use safely.
Right.
Until they're ready, wherever they're at in their stages of change, we support them toward right. healing, even at the small level. So if our listeners want to give themselves some kind of a scale, 0 to 10, where they think they're at right now, how much awareness they're giving to their physical self after this conversation, that would be a really great place to start. And then we could move on to the next round.
So before we do that, one thing I'm thinking too, that you talked about these different areas, and it sounds to me like you could even within that quadrant, you could even rate each of those things. Where are you with sleep, with movement, with food, with water, with, can't remember what else you said.
Yeah, you can break it down.
Then you're also not only seeing, because I see that the, like you were saying, that you're working, you've got them divided into quadrants, but they all feed into each mm-hmm. other. And I could see that the wheel not only gives you an idea of what each quadrant is happening in each quadrant, but also by seeing the four quadrants together, you're also seeing the interaction of the quadrants.
Yeah, that's
right?
Eventually where we get,
yeah.
where we start doing that crossover. Like someone does yoga and they put yoga right in the middle,
yes.
where it's touched physically, mentally, spiritually,
right.
and emotionally. It's
right.
all connected for sure.
And that can also happen within the quadrants themselves. If you're rating each of those things you talked about in the physical, you can also see where things are out of balance potentially in there as well. So,
well, that makes me think of when I was delivering this message, the Wellness Wheel message, to the chronic pain group at the Comox Valley Nursing Center. And the participants took the physical and made a separate wheel. They took the intellectual and made a separate wheel.
Oh, yeah.
And under emotional, which is all about relationship, beginning with the relationship with yourself, which we'll talk about more later, but they had each relationship that was important in their life, their primary relationships, under emotional.
Right.
With the primary relationship being the one with themselves, and then moving outward in the concentric circles of who was important in their intimacy. So the other thing that comes up there is if you wanted to take this to the next level, and certainly the listeners who are keeners will probably be doing this already, is dividing that realm, say the physical, into what you say you believe
right.
about physical wellness and how much time you actually give it. And that's just a congruency check when you're doing core value work. It's like, do you value this? Then how are you working it in a real and practical way in your life? Which brings me back to the broken record of making an appointment with yourself
right.
for those activities under the physical realm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that kind of wraps up the physical realm for now, although I'm sure that I'll be thinking of other ideas that I can bring forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great that gives us a nice little overview of that first quadrant. So where would you like to go next?
So I think the best thing to do, Cara, is just to move right into the intellectual domain on the wellness wheel and just really focus in on that for a while. And I recognize that the mental realm or the intellectual realm is the default position for most of the people that I see. In my private practice, most of the men and women that I see are professionals who have used their brain to earn whatever piece of paper they needed to earn to get a way to make a living or to follow their calling or their vocation. So they spend a lot of time in their brain, and their mind becomes their safety place, their escape location. And I understand that. I get that. It is a default for a lot of people in North American culture.
Yeah.
And I understand it as a defense mechanism that is learned at a very young age. Where to go when the world gets scary? Well, you can escape to your head. You can read. You can daydream. You can think about big ideas. You can dream about your ideals. You get together with your friends and have long, intense philosophical discussions, and you're safely in your head. And I acknowledge that. I have compassion for that position. It's an excellent, safe position, and it's a defense mechanism that's used commonly.
I can certainly relate to that. It's definitely my default. It's my happy place.
So my goal is not to strip you of your blanket, your defense mechanism. I don't make a habit of doing that, but I would invite people to be conscious of when they're using it, so that if they can acknowledge, oh, I'm doing it. I'm aware that I'm doing it, and not beat themselves up about it. And I should be doing this, or I should be feeling, or I should be more in my body. But just to acknowledge when they're escaping to their head and maybe do some thinking about why that might be. So the unfortunate part of being stuck in your head is that sometimes you miss the messages of the big brain. So right. The big brain is the neck down. And those messages are nonverbal. They're the messages from the deep psyche or from possibly warnings, usually expressed in the form of symptoms. So If someone is safely in their head, but then they begin to talk about their feelings, an efficient, practical way of getting them out of their head and into that feeling is to ask where they're feeling that feeling in their body.
Right.
So moving back to the big brain and locating why they might feel the need to escape. Someone who's really helpful in this regard is a writer named Michael Singer, and he's probably most famous for his book, The Untethered Soul. And he offers a way of understanding mind chatter and how it can actually undermine your best efforts to be conscious, to be in pure awareness. And he offers so many strategies in his book for people to attempt to silence what he calls the chatty roommate and how to get it out of your head and be able to focus on your feelings and what your body's messages might be sending you. Of course, when we're talking about the intellect, one of the basic survey questions from a psychotherapist's point of view, my point of view, is to check with the person around their memory and concentration, because that's a big part of the intellect. And if they're under stress or they're experiencing grief or they're going through some form of trauma or PTSD, their memory and concentration can be compromised, and they will come to me because they're concerned about the intellectual realm, the intellectual part of their medicine wheel. So then we end up spending a fair amount of time talking about strategies for accessing short-term memory, keeping lists, post-it notes, and so on. So just to be congruent, I think that all the listeners should take a moment to get out of their heads, and here's a strategy for doing that. If you're comfortable standing up, wherever you're listening to this podcast, stand up and imagine roots growing out of the bottom of your feet. And if you have a favorite tree from the woods or the forest or in your yard, imagine her, imagine that tree, and try playing a game with me, even if you feel a little silly and maybe you're in a safe place and no one's watching you. Just imagine that you're that tree. And what I'm doing is I'm bringing you back into your body, because in our culture, because we spend so much time in our head, every once in a while throughout the day, I'm going to recommend you do this and send those roots shooting out the bottom of your feet toward the center of our mother, of the earth, to the core, and draw up her energy and allow that energy to come up through the bottom of your feet and up your legs and your knees and your thighs and into your buttocks and into your root chakra. And just be very aware of being grounded and being of this earth. So if our listeners have their medicine wheel or their wellness wheel right in front of them, what they can do is just take a few seconds to consider how much attention or how much awareness they are giving to the intellectual part of their wheel. And they can color that in with pencil crayons, or they can just assign a number to it, remembering that this is all about compassion for self. And we're not setting any goals yet. We're just noticing and becoming aware of how balanced our wheel is, which is the whole point of this exercise.
Right. Yes. Well, I know my number would be pretty high on the intellectual, but it's interesting because it makes me think, you know, the idea of the balance of the wheel and everything, it makes me think about one thing that I remind myself regularly, or it's sort of a built-in program, but the idea of being the master or the slave, right? And so I want to be mindful about it. Like you said, it's not about the intellectual being wrong or bad or anything. It's about it not being the master and you're the slave, right? And so,
and being aware of when you're using it as your escape route.
Yeah.
And being okay with that. Oh, look,
Well, being curious, yeah. being curious about, okay, what's that really about? Because I value my rational mind, right? It serves me very well. So it's not about throwing it all out. It's about, like you say, really having it be in balance and you having a choice about where you're operating from. So you're conscious and that it sounds like that's what I was hearing here.
Yeah. And that's a good segue into looking at the emotional part of the wheel. And this is the part that people tend to avoid because they think, or they've been raised in families or our culture doesn't encourage necessarily talking about their feelings. But that's changing. And I acknowledge that. So let's move. It feels natural to move to that.
Yeah, sounds
that
good.
Quadrant of the wheel. So to start, I would invite you and the listeners, and I'm going to take this invitation myself, to think about a person or an activity or a place that makes us smile. And we all have a lot of options there. I'm choosing a particular tree in a forest that I walk in regularly. And when I think of Our Lady, and that's what I call her, it feels good. And I'm going to invite you and the listeners to think about where in their body they feel that smile, that feeling of love, of gratitude, of joy, of mindful being, of peace. Where in the body is that felt? And this is where we access emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And women in our culture they have a double-edged gift here because they're encouraged to feel. And sometimes, in the patriarchy, males lose out because they're not necessarily encouraged to explore and understand and develop a vocabulary for their feelings. And so we help them. And the men that I see in my practice, they appreciate that. I'm sensitive to that. On the flip side, sometimes for women, emotions are romanticized. They're elevated to this position that dictates the day. They're romanticized to the point where too much focus is given to the almighty feeling. And I find myself repeatedly reminding the women that I serve that they can think and feel at the same time.
Mm.
That it's possible to be aware and conscious of your feelings while you're having them. The research that we have now on women and girls around age 9, between 9 and 12, where they've been taught that the emotion is the almighty master, but they hit what we call cognitive dissonance when that encouragement to feel is then blocked when it meets with disapproval in our culture.
Yeah, and that's the wrong feeling.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate because they've been told up to that point that they're encouraged to feel. And then when they do, it's either dismissed or it's used as a way, in a pejorative way. Oh, she must be PMSing. Or she must be premenstrual, or it must be hormones. And it's very disrespectful to women, But around between 9 and 12, prepubescent, we have our girls feeling, looking for unconditional love. And then when they realize that the culture really actually has conditions, so do parents, so do partners, boyfriends, girlfriends, then they begin this movement that Carol Gilligan talks about in her book, In a Different Voice, where they settle for approval.
Mm-hmm.
They suddenly realize, usually unconsciously, they're not going to get the unconditional love that is their birthright. So they begin to realize what positive reinforcement they're getting from the culture, or boyfriends or girlfriends or partners or friends or parents. And that positive reinforcement encourages them to seek approval mm-hmm. instead.
Mm-hmm.
And what Carol Gilligan noticed in her research was that girls' voices change. When they're telling the truth, their voice modulation is different. It's a deeper timbre. When they're lying or pretending or seeking approval, the voice register actually goes up.
Right.
And she tracked this.
Mm-hmm.
And some of her work, Women, Girls, and Psychotherapy is another one of her books that just will astound you on the ways that females in our culture change their truth, change their integrity to, and I'm not using manipulate in a negative way here, but it's about survival
mm-hmm.
or getting approval if you can't get love. The way they manipulate situations,
mm-hmm.
voice, clothing, the way they behave, how they become submissive, indirect, passive aggressive,
mm-hmm.
in order to get what they want.
Yeah.
Or what they feel they want and need.
Yeah.
And it's a sad situation, but it's a lot of the work I do with emotions and women.
And I don't know. I mean, it certainly starts with girls, but it seems to carry on. But it, for me, the experience is that the programming is that, yes, you need to be sensitive and kind and compassionate because that's what girls are. But the emotions you're not allowed to have are anger or frustration or disappointment or any of those. You're not allowed to have any of those, or you're certainly not allowed to express them. And so you quickly learn, like you say, how do I get around this? If I can't be angry, then I'll just be passive aggressive instead, because I somehow have to get my needs met or feel safe. I don't even think it's always approval. I think sometimes it's safety too, you know, that you realize you have to contort yourself into all sorts of different shapes to meet somebody else's expectation of who you should be.
Yeah, we become master contortionists.
Yeah.
For what some might call survival.
Mm-hmm.
That is to get what it is we need.
Yeah.
And my work is all about that is... in transactional analysis, that is in child.
Yeah.
And how to give yourself permission to be in adult. An
yeah.
adult female who can get her needs met in an adult, direct, open, authentic fashion. Which brings me to the biggest part of the emotional segment of the wheel, which surprises people sometimes in session when we get to that part of the wheel where I'll say, okay, let's get down to her. Let's have a little look at the emotional part of your wheel. Tell me about your relationships with yourself.
Right.
And
they go blank.
What? What does that have to do with emotions? But the emotional life is for women, relationship. And your first relationship is with yourself. And it reflects all of the other relationships that you have. Or rather, to be more precise, your other relationships reflect that initial relationship that you have with yourself. So it behooves you to nurture that. And to give yourself permission to be angry, as you say, to grieve, to wail the loss of something that's important to you. These are not behaviors that are encouraged in our culture. So to find a safe space, to find a safe group of women, possibly, to find a really good female friend, you or a male friend who allows you to be exactly who you are. And that is probably the best gift that a woman can give herself, is that kind of relationship, so that she can nurture her own relationship with herself. And I would say that the second biggest piece of the work that I do is I'm drawing on research now that informs the therapist that if a person can name their emotion, give it language, it changes everything in the emotional life. And so I teach how to identify nuance. I have feeling lists. Is this anxiety or is this a stressful moment? Is this confusion or is this fear? Is this frustration or is this irritability because your needs aren't being met? Is this anger or is this sadness? Is this happiness or is this exhilaration and ecstasy and joy? What is that? And teaching how to speak the language of emotions, those subtle nuances, changes everything. Because what it does, when you access the part of the brain that names things, you begin to get, as you say, outside of the washing machine. Or as Michael Singer would say, pure awareness,
right?
Or consciousness. It's a bit like naming the feeling allows you to get out of the agitation, out of the sudsy water, and sit on top of the the one that you use as an example.
Yeah, it's one that was that I had heard, and while we're on that, the languaging, I wanted to speak about another piece that it's a distinction that I use in the intuition work that I teach, right? That the difference between emotionality and feeling, that feeling is that connected emotional body that actually, and then that then sends you messages. That's, we also call it our intuition or our psychic awareness, or there's a lot of different names for it, but it's that deep seated feeling that really knows. And when you can really distinguish that from emotionality, which is when you're blah and you're basically in emotional reaction, it's a different place. It's that place you were describing where young girls who feel helpless and confused about how am I going to get my needs met when I'm getting all these conflicting messages, they get thrown into emotionality and then they're overreacting. Mm-hmm. And then they've got their hormones dealing, you know, fueling all of that as well. But that's very different from getting in touch with your actual feelings, which is that deeper intuitive part. So that's a distinction of language that I use that helps me to separate the one from the other, because they both could be labeled as emotions, but one of them's emotionality. It's an emotional reaction to the other one is an actual connecting with what's going on inside.
And yeah. Being able what to I'm understand hearing you it. Say is one, your master.
Yes.
And the other, your slave. You're reactive. One is drama and the other is a deep inner knowing that the feeling is pointing to something important.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And yeah, that's a really good point. I think what you're talking about there too, and I'm going to mix it with this notion of identifying the feeling and the nuance of feeling, is a lot of the work I do is around the double-edged nature of emotional intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because it's fantastic that the females in our culture are encouraged and develop their emotional intelligence really young. And if they can turn it back on themselves and listen to their intuition and use that intelligence in their own, you know, for their own benefit and in their own work and their own personal growth, wonderful.
Yeah.
But the other side of that is that level of emotional intelligence, unless the person's taught, encouraged how to protect themselves from being overtaxed, maybe being too empathic, not knowing how to protect themselves from the emotions that are coming at them or the mood in a room when they walk in and can sense it.
Yeah.
How to hone that intelligence in a way that keeps them detached, centered in themselves.
Being able to separate what's them and what's other.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's like that, the psychic sponge, right? Where you just...
Yeah. And picking people will up, take advantage
you're
of that.
Picking up on everything, but you're not being able to distinguish this isn't mine, this is theirs. Mm-hmm. And then you get it all over you. Energetically speaking, you're just... It's your energetic field gets all staticky because you're not differentiating yourself from other. And a lot of people who are sensitive are like that.
I think you're dead on there, Cara, because I'm thinking of the codependent work that I do, where the person loses their ability to respond to themselves. They're overly responsive to another person.
Yes.
Whether that person is addicted to a substance or an activity or a behavior, or whether they're a difficult person because they're a rageaholic, or they maybe they have chronic pain or some other, maybe a mental illness that's very difficult for them to manage, or they're not conscious of it. And that partner is overly responsive to them.
Yeah.
At their own expense.
Yeah.
And when I say over responsive, I'm talking about their ability to respond to themselves, and they forget their responsibility to themselves. So it's interesting. I mean, I have, there's a quote out there over the years from some of my work on Hornby Island and the workshops I give over there, Heartwise Communication. There was an expression that came out of my teaching that people tend to treat you the way you treat yourself.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting expression, because it's a bit of a twist on the golden rule. But this expression, people tend to treat you the way you treat yourself, that's a good meditation for, if you've got a couple of hours, you could meditate on that. But it's really about your relationship with yourself and your integrity and your self-respect and your dignity and how you get your needs met in a direct way, and acknowledging your own emotions. That will determine how other people treat you, which is, it's a fascinating.
And well, and it's so true. I've seen it time and time again, especially in your romantic relationships. It really seems to show up there. But you said something a few minutes ago that I think was key to that, is that as young women, girls, we're taught that we're supposed to be, you know, compassionate of others and kind and take care of other people and, you know, be there for people and all of that stuff. We're not taught how to do that for ourselves. And you said something a minute ago about how, you know, we learn to do for other, and then we get into our relationships and we focus on other, but we don't learn that piece of, wait a minute, let's turn that compassion and kindness and understanding and patience and regard onto ourselves, you know, first. And then from that full place, you know, share with others. But don't be sharing it all with others before you've even filled up your own, you know, your own bucket, right? And that idea of putting yourself first, not being a selfish act, but being a self-centered act, right?
Yeah, so that's really good. Really important, actually, the difference between self-care and selfish.
Yes, which in language, I've always found it so interesting that anything around self-centered, selfish, self-regard, they all have really negative connotations to them, which I find so interesting. And there's definitely a gender difference there. It's way, way worse for women to be accused of any of those things than for a man to, right? Males are supposed to be self-centered and have high self-regard, and right? They're supposed to be that. Women are not supposed to be that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so funny you should say that, because that is the reaction I get when I encourage a woman to be self-caring. That is the reaction.
Oh, that's so feels selfish. So selfish.
Yeah, and that's it. And when I say self first, as one of the spiritual laws for womanhood, we're not talking about ego.
Yeah. Well, some loud noises going by.
Speaking of ego. we're actually, you know, we're talking about the deep self.
Yeah.
That self, that's essence, that's your spirit, your inner, your core self, your spirit self, your core self, your essential self, your deep self. We're not talking about personality and ego and being self-centered and me first or any of that. We're talking about, so here's an example that might help, is when I'm working with a woman who comes across as overly responsive to other people, aka codependent, and I'm encouraging her to choose something from her wellness wheel to do for herself when she's tempted to be over-involved in someone else's business, I'll suggest solitude. I'll suggest going someplace alone and being quiet and just being with herself and listening.
What kind of response do you get? I'm curious about that, especially with
women. By myself?
Yeah.
Well, what am I going to do with the kids? And what am I going to tell my husband? Like, what am I going to say that I did? You know, where am I going to tell them that I'm going? And what am I going to do while I'm sitting there?
Which is so sad when you think about it, eh? I mean, it is just sad.
But that moment of intimacy with the deep self, more of those moments gathered together on a necklace of life leads to a deep relationship with self that's in love with self.
Yeah.
Which sounds so corny, but
or
when you experience it, there's a giddiness. There's a, this. Oh, there's
I remember this.
Yes, exactly.
From long.
When I was a little girl and I felt this giddiness and I was out in the trees and spinning around, my dress was flying around me and my hair and my braids or whatever and the wind and the trees and I'm spinning. I'm so happy. You can have that back. And it comes from a real pure place. But you need to be quiet. And you need to be still. And sometimes you need solitude and alone time to find that. It's not a frightening place at all.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because I have the opposite problem. Well, it's not, I don't really think of it as a problem, but some other people do. but I'm someone who loves my solitude. And I spend more time alone than I do with any other humans. And there are times when I actually feel a little... No, let me clarify this. I don't actually feel guilty or embarrassed, but I feel like I should feel guilty or embarrassed because I like spending so much time alone. Because there's this pressure, especially for women, that we're supposed to be social. We're supposed to be out there in the community, caring about people, helping people, you know, building community things, doing community stuff, right? And that's what good, you know, community people do. And that's definitely what good women do, right? Mm. This is the message that mm-hmm. I've received over my lifetime.
Mm-hmm. And there's a cultural myth around relatedness and women.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, if I don't feel like going out to something, to some event that is something that I really believe in, you know, I feel like, well, you should just go anyway because you really believe in this and this, you know, lend your voice to this, right? There's an argument there to be made there. And I definitely do poke myself to stretch and go out and be in public and with people and stuff, but I can only take it in very small doses, you know, and then I've got to just extract myself from all the noise and stimulus and everything and return to that place of just being with me in my brain, you know?
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing.
Yeah, and I'm sure that actually teach a lot of women your strategies because that's a lovely problem to have. I mean, our culture encourages extroversion. I mean, I'm Jungian,
yes.
So
yes.
Immediately I go, when I listen hard to you,
it's
I can
introvert.
Hear
yeah.
that I would love to have you listen to Susan Cain's TED Talk, The Power of Introversion.
Oh, yeah.
She gets up there and she says, well, I'm the last person who should be doing a TED Talk. I'm an introvert, according to Jung's definition, although in the work that I do, introversion, extroversion is on a continuum, and it's often situational.
Yes.
But the way he described it was we do tend toward one or the other in terms of energy, where we get our energy from. Mm-hmm. So an extrovert gets their energy from other people, and an introvert needs quiet, solitude time to draw energy from within or from spirit. So, you know, this culture, North American culture, celebrates the extrovert. All the kudos, all the positive reinforcement in schools, in group work, there's even expressions like the squeaky wheel gets the grease, the louder you are, the more right you are. There's all kinds of strange encouragement to be extroverted. And Susan Cain, she wrote a book called Quiet. And and
the power of introverts in a world that won't stop talking.
There it is. And for you to be able to access your quiet solitude, your intimacy with yourself, Cara, I would say that's a beautiful quality that a lot of women don't give themselves permission to have or to be.
I know I see it all the time, and I have to say that it's only been in the last probably 10 years or so that I've really begun to really embrace that aspect. And actually Susan Cain's TED Talk and then getting Quiet on audio and listening to it over and over and over, there's some incredible stuff in that book. And what I found happened was that all of a sudden I began to love my introversion. I stopped feeling like I was broken and that there was something wrong with me, that I didn't want to go out and spend time with a lot of people or even people in general. She's got some fascinating science in that book. We are even different. Introverts even have different skin sensations. We are more easily stimulated. I believe that it's the introverts that have a cooler temperature than the extroverts, which is why they tend to be often labeled as cool and aloof. Another thing that I heard that was really, I thought was so fascinating, and this was another, it was either another introvert book, because once I found Susan Cain, I started just delving into introversion because it made so much sense.
And helped you fall in love with yourself.
It did. I started to give myself permission to just be who I was and honor myself. Mm. And Dan Pink, actually, in his book, To Sell as Human, he also talks about extroverts and introverts and ambiverts, people who sit on the sort of more the center of the continuum. But I, the thing that I heard that I thought was so interesting was that it was about how introverts are perceived. So if an introvert is considered by society to be an attractive person and they're introverted, they're considered to be cold and aloof. But if an introvert is not considered attractive by whatever our social measures are, they're considered to be shy.
Wow.
Right? And I thought, wow, that is so interesting. But it's so true. You see people who are, you know, very, very beautiful, but very quiet, and they really hold back because they're introverts. And they're listening, because that's what introverts do. They observe, don't need to speak. Listen. They listen and observe. Yeah. But I just found that fascinating, because I really think that's very true of how people are perceived. You know,
I'm glad you told me about your shoulds about 7 minutes ago when you talked about feeling like you should be out there.
Yeah.
You should. And that's the relational myth, too. I mean, yes, women are relational, but the primary relationship is with the self.
Yeah.
And that's not what we're taught.
And I've always felt more male because I don't have that. Mm. I don't want to mother anybody. Mm. I don't like cooking for people. I don't even like to cook. I you know, if I had my druthers to be with another sentient being, it would be dogs, right? Or... well, dogs would be first, but any other animal would come before a human, probably.
Yeah. Right?
And of course, there are certain humans in my life that are, you know, more important than anything other than me, you know, but there's a small handful. Yeah. We tend to go for quality over quantity.
Yeah. You know? Well, that actually brings me to another piece of the emotional quadrant of the wheel that I work with women, is their sphere of influence, or their circles. So they have themselves in the center, their most important person, the one they're most responsible for. And then in the next circle, who's safe? Who's in? Who is your panel? And not your panel because you're accountable to them, but these people love you unconditionally. They have your best interests at heart. They always have your back, and you go to them to keep yourself accountable to yourself.
Because you know they'll tell you the truth. They'll do it lovingly, but they'll tell you the truth.
And then the next circle, and the next circle, and the next circle, and people can visualize as you move out. You might have around the third or fourth circle out your dose, well, what we call our dose friends, right? Those are the people you can do about 20 minutes with, and then you're done. But you don't really want to exclude them from your life.
No.
Right? But but you know your tolerance level.
Yeah.
You love them, but in doses.
Yeah.
And then when women do this relational exercise, and they begin to see that with themselves at the center, they get to choose. They get to re-examine who's in what level. Who's truly safe?
I bet it
and can. Who's, I should be hanging out with this person.
Right.
I should like this person, but I don't. What's wrong with me?
Yeah.
And then this process of discernment begins. And there's a freedom and a release. And
I would imagine there'd be some surprises in
it's
the process.
Wonderful, like, wonderful.
Recognizing, this person is a dose person. I didn't realize that, right? And there are people that I feel like I'm supposed to be, you know, not in my case, my mother, but for some people, it could be a mother or a sibling or whatever, you know, that was kind of like, I'm supposed to love them and want to spend time with them, but really I can only handle them in small doses.
Yeah. And when a woman asks me, well, how do I determine that? You know exactly what I'm going to say. It's where in your body do you feel, what happens to your body when you're with this person?
Yeah.
Like, do your insides, do you clench your guts? Or notice your hands, right. What you're doing with your hands when you're with this person. Right. Are they loose? Are they open? How much time are you spending listening? And how much time are you spending talking?
Right.
How fair is it?
And draining, like feeling drained after being with them. I would imagine that would be one too,
right? A
real
key.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the body knows.
Yeah, the body is truly brilliant. I know I have a couple of friends who are people like that, who I love dearly, and I can really only handle them in smaller doses, you know.
It's so good for you to know that about yourself.
Yeah, and I definitely, you know, like with everything, I want to stretch myself. But yeah, it is that self-care that's most important, right? And it's easier as you get older. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's like you give yourself permission not to care what other people think so much.
You do. And I don't know whether it's some kind of if it's a hormonal thing or whether it's just an age and experience thing. But it certainly seems that once you hit 50, you start being a little bit more circumspect about where you spend your energy, especially if you're working towards consciousness. Like if you're one of your goals is to be more conscious all the time and evolve.
You recognize how precious your energy is.
Yeah. And where do you want to spend it? You know?
So I'm going to encourage listeners to go to their wheel, have a look at their emotional, the emotional quadrant, and kind of spend some time thinking about how much attention they're actually giving it in the context of this conversation and the things that we've talked about today.
Yeah. Sounds good. Okay, so we've done the physical, the intellectual, the emotional. So now we're going to start the fourth quadrant, which is the spiritual. So let's dive in.
So once again, Cara, I just want to remind listeners that we divide the wellness wheel into four quadrants for the sake of convenience. It's, you know, our lives are not split into four domains, but it's helpful for people to understand that this is a way of looking at balance. It's a way of looking at our lives in a compassionate way to how much attention are we actually paying to these four important realms. And there are more. And the spiritual realm tends to overlap all of them,
right.
All the others. So I think maybe the best place to start is with the name of my practice. So Spirit First Counseling came out of a recognition of a gift in myself that I noticed pretty young, that I could see a person's spirit first, before their gender, before their age, skin color, how much money they had or didn't have. It was something that I recognized in myself, and it seemed the perfect name for a counseling practice.
Oops.
It doesn't mean that I'm a New Age wingnut, and it doesn't mean that I'm a Christian fundamentalist. It means more that I'm syncretic, and syncretic is a term that describes some pretty thorough, deep exploration and practice of various world religions and wisdom traditions.
Oh, cool.
And knowing where they overlap and understanding that almost every religion has a flood story and every religion has death and resurrection story, and every religion has these myths or these archetypal stories or narratives, and where they overlap on a Venn diagram for me personally is where it feels loving,
right? Yeah.
And I'm choosing to not participate in anything else, especially if it's fear-based.
Yeah.
So that's syncretic in a nutshell.
That's interesting. This is a word I don't know, syncretic. And when I hear a word I don't know, my mind automatically goes to what's the root of the word. Like, so synchra or that meeting of, you know, what's synchronous about it. Syncretic, is that a word that's used around religion specifically, or is it generally a word? I'd grab my dictionary and look it up.
I think the best way to describe syncretic is to maybe talk a little bit about what it isn't. It isn't eclectic.
Okay.
It isn't riding the fence. It isn't non-committal. It's based on a thorough study, reading, and practice in a variety of spiritual traditions. So at some point, maybe you and I can do a podcast on what that experience was like.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Participating in Trappist monastic life, participating in days of silence, participating in various religions and their practices, and seeing how they felt in my body and how it aligned with or didn't align with what I felt to be true in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a willy-nilly snap your fingers, this is what I'm going to do. It's a very broad perspective of religion and spirituality.
Yeah, yeah.
So I say that because people, I know, sometimes make some assumptions when they see spirit first counseling. Okay, so I'm not spiritual, so maybe she's not the counselor for me. But the thing about it is, I really believe that our culture doesn't give credence or enough emphasis to spiritual resources as a way of healing.
Yeah.
Right? It's very... people seem more willing to talk about sexuality, which for many people is clearly a private matter, and not talk about spirituality.
Right.
Yeah. And they kind of mix up the two. And I would like to open the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Just to talking about spiritual practices and what that means. And so usually I start with the difference that a person who's seeing me, what's the difference for that person? So if the listeners can put themselves in position with me, what do you think are the differences between spirituality and religion? It's a good place to start.
Yeah.
Because a lot of assumptions then come to the surface. And I'll get things like, religion is organized group of people who decide to believe the same thing, and they get validated when they're in their group and they have practices and readings and ways of behaving with each other, and there's a norm that's followed. Spirituality for a lot of people is a little bit more personal. Mm-hmm. So it might not necessarily be in a church setting or an organized club or group setting. It might be more that they find a sense of connection to their deepest self, immanence, I call that, at the same time that they are experiencing this connection to something larger than they are, that is, feels intelligent, that feels purposeful and mindful, and that's transcendence. So there's this coming together of immanence, something that's felt deeply, and something that transcends this form, this body, this earth, something that's almost unspeakable. So that immanence and transcendence, people tend to come to that place when they're talking about spirituality. It's quite personal.
Yeah.
At the same time that it's not personal. So,
and not something that they talk about like on a regular basis or anything. And they choose who they talk about it with. And like you say, because it is very personal. And I think a lot of people have that same sort of feeling where they feel like if they just open it up in a conversation, that it may be misunderstood, as you say, that they're highly religious, or that, you know, that, you know, I just think a lot of people have a discomfort around talking around about spirituality around a lot of people. They're very selective about who they'll speak that with.
Yeah, right? I listen to you speak that way. And I think that some of this comes from either or thinking, a discomfort with ambiguity. Mm-hmm. That, so what I try to teach in my practice is that it's the questions that you want to really focus on. The mysteries, we don't know the answers. So how do you want to live your life? How do you want to ask the deep questions and open the dialogue and listen with respect to what other people have to say and think about your own personal beliefs and not have necessarily definitive answers, but to be able to live with not knowing? And that's not a popular position in our culture.
No.
So to offer it as an opportunity for people to heal, they're coming to me because they're grieving or because they're trying to heal from some form of trauma, or they're questioning their marriage, or they're experiencing depression or anxiety in this form that they're in. And their spiritual resources in our culture, they're neglected. We're not teaching our children all the time how to access that deeper questioning and that deeper knowing. The answers aren't all out there somewhere else, given by somebody else, or in the form of medication or in a book, or
yeah,
that there is beautiful work that can be done if you give yourself permission to be quiet and be centered in yourself and just experience the question physically, emotionally, intellectually, and now I'm adding spiritually, to sit with it. We don't teach people how to do that.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably why I spend so much time on it in my practice.
Well, I know in my capacity as someone who, you know, teaches people how to develop their intuitive abilities and that what I've come across more than I can relay in my life is people who say to me, I'm so glad that I can talk to you about this, because, you know, if I talk to anybody about this stuff, they just think I'm weird or whatever. And the funny thing is the number of people who've said that to me. So it's like there's all these people who are feeling like they can't discuss this big aspect of themselves, you know, which, I mean, I relate the two, that intuitive ability and that inner knowingness, that connection to who we are deep inside, mm-hmm, and that spirituality, mm-hmm, basically. Mm-hmm. So there's all these closeted people who are, you know, not feeling safe to talk about this stuff because they don't know how they're going to be labeled or how it might affect their credibility or whatever. And yet, you know, you collect a group of them in a room and they're so happy to be able to talk about this stuff with other people and realize there's other people that are experiencing the same thing, right? So I just find it so, mm-hmm, interesting. And especially because I work in an educational institution some of the time, and, you know, the academics are very, very much, you've got to be so careful about, mm-hmm, talking about any of the woo-woo stuff, mm-hmm, because you'll immediately lose credibility. Mm-hmm. And yet get them in a room with a glass of wine, you know, one-on-one, and all of a sudden they're sharing all sorts of stuff with you that they're not going to be sharing with other people, mm-hmm, with their colleagues, right? And I just think it's sad, but I also understand it, because, mm-hmm, we do confuse, mm-hmm, religion and spirituality, mm-hmm, and I consider them to be very different things. I, mm-hmm, think there's a lot of religions that are very lacking in spirituality, mm-hmm, and and very, very many spiritual practices that don't fit into any kind of a category of religion.
Yeah.
You know, so
I want to convey my gratitude to you for being one of the people who provides safe space quite well so that we can talk about these things together and not feel ashamed, embarrassed, wondering what people think. And religion, now, there are people who come to me with a very strong religious faith, and they want to work on their issue with their faith as a tool. And I respect that, and I work with them. I was a practicing Christian for many years. In fact, I was a lay minister in the United Church of Canada. So I understand that faith can heal and can be an amazing resource for people. So I'm happy to work that as a resource in their healing journey. But I'm also encouraging people to open up to other ways of experiencing spirit besides within the four walls of a church.
Mm-hmm.
So some of my clients discover that they are actually, they have a spiritual practice and they didn't even know it. So I might say, where do you reach that stillness and that deep connection to yourself and then your connection to something bigger than you? And they do some thinking about that and they might say, walking on the beach or meditating by the ocean or climbing a mountain or cycling, mountain biking or gardening or in the forest on their daily walk or when they play with their grandchildren and they look into those eyes and hear their laughter. Spirit, that sense of spirituality can be found in so many ways, in so many places. And I bring that to the surface as a resource for healing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I derailed you at the beginning.
No, this is great because it also leads me to think about how religion has worked against people's healing in some cases. And it's tragic and it's sad. And the grief work that's involved in unlearning some of the shame-based, fear-based religious practices and beliefs that they've come out of. In fact, in some cases, it is that shame-based, fear-based, you are a sinner, you're going to hell dogma that has actually put them in an unhealthy place mentally.
Yeah.
So then we begin the work of unlearning and deconstructing. And that's a tough one,
yeah.
I have to tell you.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Sad, it's tragic, it's...
And the number of people, you know, I've met a few people who, you know, were involved in a very strict fear-based religion who, you know, and their family raised them in that, and where they to survive, they had to reject all of that. And in rejecting all of that, they were alienated from their families. Mm-hmm. And were still alienated from their spirituality. And yet so many of them will share with me experiences where they keep getting pulled back to it, pulled back to it, pulled back to it. But it's not within the context of the religion. It's within the context of them just knowing that they're connected to something greater, that their purpose here is something more important than, you know, the mundane. And they have that sense of it, and they're pulling back. They're trying to find their way back to it. And I just think it's so tragic because I believe that we all come in as these beautiful Holy Spirits. And so to then have it bastardized in that way to the point where you have to reject it because you're throwing a baby out with the bathwater, right? Mm-hmm. It's so incongruent. In some cases, you know, some of the people I've worked with have been abused in that context. And so then they're completely mixed up because spirit is then tied up with all this trauma. And yet they're highly spiritual people. And so finding their way back is incredibly difficult, you know? So, yeah, I am. Yeah.
And I also encourage people, if they're bringing to me, while my faith is strong, I participate in this particular religion, or I like this church, I encourage people to take responsibility for understanding the dogma of their particular religion, to study the scripture, and to understand that some of the things that are taught in particular fundamentalist churches are actually hate crimes. Mm-hmm. If you look at the universal human rights, and actually take the time and responsibility to delve into what your church is actually teaching about loving everyone, and the church's position on women as leaders in the church, and your church's position on homosexuality, and your church's position on racism. Mm-hmm. So I believe it's each person's responsibility to delve into that, to figure out, oh, I didn't maybe really even realize that my church held this belief, and that as a member of this church, I'm actually saying that I represent that belief, and it's a hate crime. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. Oh my goodness, what do I do now? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the work, yeah, too. So yeah, you can see how it can get quite complicated.
Absolutely, yeah.
And not only that, well, as a feminist therapist, I have to look at what happened to women in the growth and development of the monotheistic male image of God in religion. Mm-hmm. And where women fit in her story and in leadership roles, and how honored motherhood is, and raising children, and keeping families loving each other and connected, and how are women elevated in these particular religious traditions. So that plays a factor in my work as well.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I have to say that's a big part of what Spirit First Counseling is all about.
Yeah.
It comes up.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank goodness you're doing that.
Well, I take it pretty seriously, this responsibility. In fact, so much so that when I was training in my master's degree, there were all kinds of electives. There were all courses that we could take, but no one offered how to use spirituality as a resource in counseling. There was no elective in my program, and right, it's a good program. It was rigorous. It required a lot of work and personal. We had to participate in every psychotherapeutic practice that we would ask our clients to participate in. So I'm not complaining about the rigor, but there was no coursework on incorporating spiritual resources. Mm-hmm. So I created a course for master's degree students in how to use spiritual resources in counseling.
Cool.
So that book is out there, and people can, I can give a link later,
yeah,
how to access that coursework.
Wow. That's very cool.
Yeah.
Cause that's another thing, is this huge gap between science and spirituality, and how it seems to have been perceived. And I know that it's starting to change, but it's very slow moving, but it's kind of that this mutually exclusive place, right? Mm-hmm. Where if you're being scientific, spirituality has nothing to do with it. And if you're being spiritual, then there's no science behind it. It's all just belief. And this is where I find it interesting, because it's, to me, spirituality is more about your values, how you operate in the world. You know, are you in integrous with your word? Are you in alignment with your, do you live in alignment with your values? To me, that's more about spirituality. Mm-hmm. It's not about rules of conduct, but it is about the reality that we know right from wrong, some very basic things like doing unto others what you would have them do unto you, which to me seems pretty simple. But you know, it's like, what are your values? Are you living in alignment with what you believe to be right? It's not about dogma and belief and rituals and all of that,
which more personal.
I could see coming out of that. Mm-hmm. But, and so how can we separate science? Because there has to be ethics and values in science. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested in the bridge between those two things, but I'm not surprised that any good scientifically based training is not going to incorporate spiritual aspects because there's this perception that, you know, you're dragging in all this fantasy into the world of reality.
Mm-hmm. The only bridge, Cara, that I've been able to find in my work, and this is relatively new, I would say the last maybe 15 years of my studies, is the overlap that I experience in energy work. Mm-hmm. So that's scientific. There's no doubt about it. And spirituality actually intersects with energy at that level.
Yes.
And more scientists. I mean, when I think about my training in healing touch and Reiki, we were required to read quantum physics. That was part of our training. So the overlap there is definitely scientific. I mean, energy, now we know so much more about how it works and chaos theory and where to find equilibrium and what that feels like. So, you know, when I think about why I incorporated spirituality as such a big part of my practice, I think about why I started counseling in the first place, which was about empowerment. It was about empowering women. And for me, spirituality is about, where is your power? Where is your source? And is it out there? Is somebody giving it to you? Or are you figuring this out the really hard way? And that's making mistakes and owning them, and the humility that comes with that, which is a good humbleness, if you will, and not knowing all the answers. And you are the person who's in charge of your life. You are responsible. You're able to respond to your own sources of power and where they come from. To me, that's spirituality in a nutshell. So one of the things I ask clients to do, if they're truly interested in developing their spiritual power, if you will, or their responsibility for their own spirituality, is to spend some time thinking about their spiritual autobiography. Huh. So what's the story? Where did it start? Where did it begin? When did you stop thinking of power as mom and dad, as God, and start internalizing your own sense of God or goddess inside you? And how did that all happen? And what happens with a spiritual autobiography is it situates the person in an evolving process. So just using the word autobiography, or what's your spiritual story, it kind of implies or assumes that there was a past, there was a beginning, and here we are today talking about spirituality, and there's a future.
Right.
And that there's an assumption there that we're evolving.
Yeah.
Right? That we're not, this is what I believe. End of story. Right.
That was then, this is now, and this is now. Right. And now is everything.
Yeah. So I'm really working against black and white thinking, literal thinking. I'm trying to introduce the idea of evolving consciousness, which is spirituality in a nutshell. And that it's part of a process. It's not stagnant or static. This is what I believe. This is the church I go to. These are my people. This is the scripture. This is what we say every Sunday. This is what we do. I'm opening it up to something that's a little bit more organic and that can evolve and change. And it's surprising to me how freeing that is for a lot of people. And then I introduce the notion of the metaphor for the journey, the symbol or the archetype for the work we're going to do together. One of the first pieces of homework is to send people off to think about what kind of, what symbol, what metaphor, what archetype do you want to use for this chapter? Now, if we worked last year, your your archetypal journey, your symbol might have been how an eagle searches for food. And that might have been your dream imagery. It might have been crossing a desert and seeing a Bedouin or a mirage in the, and you're approaching it slowly. Or maybe your metaphor was a river and making your way down the side of the river over stones and deciding when to cross and when to come back. Or maybe your metaphor was the life of an animal in your mind and what they do during the day and how they do their year if they hibernate and how they hunt. So this is not typical psychotherapy. This is spiritually integrated work, which means that it's going to inform your dreams. It's going to inform your thoughts, your psyche. Our work together is going to be feel a little bit otherworldly, but grounded in reality. Like, how can you bring all of this into that reading your child a book tonight, mm-hmm. or that conversation that you're going to have with your boss, or how you're going to prepare dinner? You know, it's huge.
Yeah.
So it's not a little spirituality integrated into therapy. It's multifaceted.
I can imagine.
Yeah. It's pretty profound work.
So this is all, we're talking about the spiritual quadrant of the wheel. I mean, that was the idea. I know I kind of took us off track.
No, it's wonderful. I'm sure our listeners are like, wow, okay.
What about the wheel?
Can you bring us back?
What am I supposed to
well,
do?
Well, actually, we can. So the listeners can actually spend some time thinking about how much time do I actually spend thinking about this? I mean, self-compassion was the key you and I sort of established with the wheel. Mm-hmm. But isn't it interesting to look at those four quadrants and go, well, how much time am I actually spending? And what do I say I value? And how much time do I give it? And how congruent am I? So with self-compassion, without judgment.
Yeah. And of course, you know, looking at a lot of the organized religions, especially the Christian-based ones, you know, there's that idea of, you know, you're spiritual on Sunday and the rest of the time you're yourself, right? But it, giving yourself that little sort of like, this is a compartment where I'm allowed to be spiritual. And it's interesting because I have a garden that's right next to a church. So I'm often in my garden when they come out of the service on Sunday. And, you know, I find it interesting because I know that I was raised Catholic, so I know what it was like to go to church and be there for the Mass and then leave after. And there's that, you know, you're there, you're listening, you might be moved by the sermon, you're with your community and you might have conversations with people and you're feeling good. You're feeling like you're pulling yourself into your best self. You know, you're trying to embody what you've learned from the sermon or whatever. And then you leave there and it's almost like there's this bleeding period where you can hold on to that for a little while, but then the next thing you know, you're back into your life and your spirituality is kind of tucked back into the suitcase until the next time you have the opportunity for that compartment to open, mm-hmm. you know?
I'm really glad you brought that up because I help people to see that they have spiritual practices and they didn't even know they had them. Mm-hmm. So it's languaging. It's, oh, you mean when I'm gardening and meditating and feeling really calm and peaceful and happy, that's a spiritual practice? Yes. Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or when you're kind to someone who's driving you crazy, but you can find the compassion to understand why they're where they are right now and pull on your patience. You know, that to me is a spiritual practice.
Or the spiritual practice of gratitude. Mm-hmm. Remembering that gratitude actually changes the brain. We have research now on what happens to the prefrontal cortex when people express gratitude. And that's a spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. It changes your perception of your world.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and mindfulness is another, it's a big part of my practice for that very reason. Because mindfulness allows us to become the witness to our own journey. And that changes everything.
Yeah.
Right? And yes. That's a spiritual practice. And I don't know that everyone really acknowledges how spiritual they really are.
Yeah.
So though, I do want to offer one caution with symbolism and metaphor. And I was preparing for our podcast this morning and I thought, you know, I don't think that I would be doing a disservice if I didn't talk about our responsibility as evolved conscious beings to even question our symbols and question our metaphors. And this comes out of Starhawk's The Spiral Dance, where she's talking about creating a religion in the future. She's talking here about absolutism, which stems from an intolerance of ambiguity, which harkens back to me when you and I first started talking about not knowing all the answers. Our culture is highly symbol bound, she says, and we carry the unconscious assumption that symbolic systems are the realities they describe.
Oh, yeah.
If the description is the reality and descriptions differ, only one can be true. Which,
wow.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Either God created Adam and Eve, or they evolved a la Darwin. Either unresolved unconscious conflicts are the final cause of our unhappiness, or economic material conditions. We may change ideologies, but we do not examine the underlying idea that there is one right, true, and only way, ours, and everybody else is wrong. I love her conversation and her discussion around absolutism.
Yeah.
Because it's just brilliant. Like, everyone wants answers. And they grab them.
Yeah.
And this is true, and now I feel safe.
Yeah.
And yet, we haven't developed in our culture comfort with just not knowing.
Yeah.
Right? Which really shuts things down.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not open. It's not an opening.
Yeah.
So I offer that for what it's worth.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Very nicely written too. Succinct. Yeah. Very interesting because it made me think of that. And I don't remember whether we've talked about this before. We probably have. But that idea of one of the things that I say is the three most dangerous words in the English language are, I know that. You know, it's like it just shuts the door, you know, and we are so addicted to answers and the power is in the questions, mm-hmm. You know,
so no question about that.
And the answers are all about an illusion of control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's like, do you want to be, are you feeling satisfied with your illusion of control? You know, because it is in fact an illusion, right? And what's going to happen when the rug gets pulled out from underneath you?
And it will.
Yeah.
Because life is life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, back to the wheel and people thinking, well, how can I have spiritual practices in my life? What does that mean? I like to introduce my clients to this idea that you can sanctify anything. You want to be mindful in a moment, you can light a candle.
Yeah.
Right? And you can ritualize or ceremonialize or sanctify, that is, spiritualize a moment by saying, okay, I am entering a moment here. This is the beginning. I'm lighting a candle. That means it's important. I'm experiencing the moment and I'm blowing the candle out. Takes seconds.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is such a easy, freeing practice. You can do it anywhere. And I do it in session. So when they come in, I hit a gong, I light a candle. It's a sacred space. And they get the idea they can be comfortable with that.
Uh-huh.
And they're reaching their deeper selves or their higher self or however you want to describe that state of grace, that state of being. And time changes. You know, the time-space continuum. Our hour goes very quickly together. But it's good work, and it's sometimes I invite clients to create an altar, and even just using the word altar for them connotates woo-woo. And I say, you know what, really all you're doing is acknowledging. Let's just acknowledge the four directions. Let's start with a very simple altar where you might have a little bit of dirt. You might have a feather for air. You might have a bowl of water. You might light a candle. So earth, air, fire, water. You can create something very simple. And the whole point of sanctification is there's all this stuff going on in what feels like the real world, and it's busy and people talking. If you just take a moment to separate out silence and time alone and a moment of introspection, that is spirituality.
Yeah.
Right. And it changes their healing in big ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I like that word sanctify too, because it does, it is like a, it's, to me, that word means you're choosing it, right? It's like, it's your intention that is choosing whatever it is and making that sacred. It's your word saying, this is the sacred moment.
Where's
however,
the power?
However you legitimize it or however you do it. It's that intention of that moment, as you say, where you go within. You know, and even if it's just for a moment, mm-hmm. it's incredibly powerful. Mm-hmm.
And then they love it because they expand it to that moment with their partner. And then they expand it to that moment with their child. And they light a candle before they eat.
Uh-huh.
And it's not religious in that sense, in the fundamental or literalist. It's honoring.
Yeah.
And it's giving thanks for food. And does it matter who?
Yeah.
Does it really matter who they're giving thanks to?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's the planet, the animal that died to become this dinner.
Yeah, it really doesn't matter.
You know, it doesn't.
It's the moment.
It's pretty simple.
I think that's unfortunately where a lot of organized religions get caught. You know, like they probably start out from that incredible, connection and fire from within, and then attach all these rules and dogma and belief and everything to it. And before we, you know it, there's no spirituality left in it. You know, it's just a whole bunch of control and fear.
And then you have the inner gatekeepers and the people who are vigilant about who's following the rules. Then we have judgment. And then we have who's in the club and who's not in the club.
Yeah.
And even judging the people who are in the club for not behaving properly according to this rule.
Yeah, it just gets so far from spirituality, and it's it's actually, it's one of the reasons why I'm actually grateful that there are more and more people who are stepping away from organized religion, because they're starting to question some of those, a lot of the incongruent rules and beliefs and everything, you know, love everyone except if they're not the right color or they're not the right gender or they're not the whatever, right?
Mm-hmm. Or love them because they're sinners, but don't let them act on who they are. Yeah. That's okay then.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't make any sense. Like, what kind of twist of emotional, ethical, intellectual, spiritual logic do you have to do with your brain and your heart and your soul to arrive at that conclusion? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We love everyone except mm-hmm. how they behave.
Yeah.
What? How does that work?
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know.
So the skepticism and the more analytical thought that's coming into it, it's like it's almost pulling out some of those lines, those energetic lines from those belief systems and structures, and allowing people to actually find their real, authentic spirituality within, whatever that looks like.
Yeah. You know? And I can't emphasize enough the personal responsibility for that. Mm-hmm. It's so much easier to give that responsibility over to other people, to a political leader or to a church.
Yeah. And to remain in the child position instead of stepping into the spiritual adult. Yeah.
And take responsibility.
Yeah.
And that requires thought. It requires time and space. So I think that's probably why I emphasize mindfulness so much in my practice. And it begins with some clients, I just start with the core practice, which is we hit the gong together. We listen to the sound of the gong, the tone reverberating as long as we can. When we don't hear the tone anymore, we go to our breath. And we count to five, breathing in. Listeners can do it if they like. And we count to five, breathing out. We do that a couple of times, breathing in and breathing out, counting. I hit the gong again. We listen to the gong as long as we can. And we're done. And it might take 2 minutes. It's called the core practice. Mm-hmm. And when I'm teaching it to children in schools, the little ones get it. They are like, can you come and teach the core practice to my mom? Because when she drives me to my program, she's yelling at the drivers. Or can you come and teach that, the core practice, to my dad? Because sometimes he loses his temper and scares me. Uh-huh. So, and I'll say to the little guy, you can teach it. So they teach it to each other. And it's wonderful.
Yeah.
But I teach it in relation to the brain. So if I'm doing mindfulness with children or adults, we'll talk about the amygdala and the fear response and what is that. And what happens to the prefrontal cortex when the amygdala is in overdrive. And where in their hippocampus are they drawing on a memory from trauma. And children can come running to me and say, Miss Terry, my amygdala lied to me. And I thought he was stealing my ball, but really it was rolling over toward him and he was actually picking it up to bring back to me. My amygdala lied to me. Can we do the core practice right now? Like, kids get it in a beautiful, wonderful, beautiful way.
Yeah.
And mindfulness is for everybody.
Yeah.
And what it does is it stops time for a moment so you can take responsibility for your thoughts.
Yeah.
And have a response rather than a reaction. And if we can teach that to children.
Oh, yeah, that would be.
Mm-hmm. Right? In a scientific brain kind of way, and yet it's spiritual at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. I think that would be wonderful. Imagine what the world would be like if kids were taught that automatically in school.
Well, it's available. It's curriculum. It's available in the British Columbia school system.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I go into schools and teach it. And the children love it. So do the teachers. We teach it under the guise of self-regulation.
Right.
Which makes the most
sense. You've got to give it a rational kind of term so that the decision makers don't get all twitched out.
Well, yeah, you can't make it too woo-woo.
We're not teaching the kids meditation.
No,
we're really not.
Don't think we are.
We're teaching them self-regulation.
Another piece that comes into my practice in a big way that describes spirit-first counseling as spiritually integrated is I teach about reparenting the self. And this is huge. And I'm wondering, do we want to work with that today, or do you want to give our listeners a break and maybe come back to that? It's a huge concept.
Yeah, I think it is probably another episode, because it is a really big piece.
I will just say this then, just to bring the spiritual, that piece to a close, because we really, yeah, it's about introducing ideas. And let me say a couple more things about spirituality and the spiritual domain, or the spiritual quadrant on your wheel. Listeners can think about a couple of things. Taking responsibility for parenting themselves is a spiritual practice. So we'll talk about that in another podcast, I think. Looking at your own values, what you would stand for, is a spiritual practice that I bring into my counseling sessions. So I do a lot of values clarification so that they can figure out what's authentic and what's true for them. How can we make a spiritual practice a default, a knee-jerk, an automatic response to our world every day? From the moment we wake up or walking down the street, how can we mindfully wash dishes? How can we smile at a stranger, send good energy to someone in a motor vehicle accident? How can we do this on a regular basis?
Right.
Make it a daily practice.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's spirituality in a nutshell. So listeners can, I invite you just to look at the whole wheel and go, wow, where am I at in these four domains? How balanced do I feel? How balanced do I want to be? What little thing can I do to make a change in my life that would bring me closer to my sense of being congruent? To being authentic and moving through the world in an authentic way.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, that's, yeah, that's a wonderful wrap, I think, of the four quadrants. And so I think that, you know, I'm going to encourage our listeners to really follow through on this and look at their own wheel. And so if people wanted to get in touch with you or find out more about you, I'm going to encourage them to go to your website, which is terryfolks.com.
No, www.spiritfirstcounseling.com.
Okay. All right. And that'll be a link in the show notes as well. So people can go directly there. And we'll also have number of resources that we've talked about and that sort of thing. But I wanted to thank you very much. This has been very illuminating and really fun to do. I'm looking forward to some of the other pieces that we're going to work on that you use in your practice. And yeah.
Can I thank you?
Yes, absolutely.
So here's the thing. It's wonderful to do a podcast with someone who understands these principles and it has your own language for them.
Mm-hmm.
And to talk to someone who gets it. I appreciate your intelligence
and how articulate
you are. And it really makes a difference. And I also really appreciate, Kara, your questions and your comments. The questions in particular, because it forces me to articulate the work that I do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. And thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed that episode with Terry Folks. You can find links to all the resources on the show notes page,
You can also leave comments there. We'd love to hear any insights that you got throughout the program. You can visit Terry at her website at spiritfirstcounseling.ca. And you also have the option on the show notes page to opt in, and we'll notify you by email when the next episode is available. We'll be recording that in the next few weeks. So thanks again for listening. Once again, you'll find all that information at caraforman.com/wellnesswheel. And I hope you'll join us next time.